I'm Author Function.
I'm Galvin.
And this is the Secret Boss Podcast, where we talk about the best auteurs in gaming, whether they deserve that title or not. And today we are talking about Toshio Iwai, who, according to every mid-2000s journalist I've seen, is not a person who makes games. He makes non-games.
Let's spend an hour talking about this author. Are these games? Let's not talk about any of the content of what he's making or like any of his artistic statements or anything. Let's just debate definitions for the next hour. I think that'll be really a really fun episode. Yeah.
Yeah, the way
who cares?
That was like talking point for such a long time, whether this specific game or not is a game. That is such a weird part of video game history. And nowadays, I don't think anyone really cares. We're just willing to go with whatever definition for a game. But back then, that was a real concern.
Even now, you go on backlog reviews of like Electroplankton and people are still talking about whether or not it's a toy. Or it's like, isn't it funny that people paid $40 for this 20 years ago? Who cares? He was making art, okay? Let's talk about the art.
Yeah. So the controversy with a lot of these games is that EY makes a lot of music-based games that are open-ended without a lot of direction or goals, and they're really more about the act of producing music than it is about, say, beating the boss or getting a high score.
I saw someone call them non-pejoratively toys, kind of like a toy piano or something like that, and I would agree with that. It's like partially a tool to generate some things, but also it's something to play around with without necessarily an end objective.
Is there a good close analog to this? I can't think of one, to be honest. I was thinking KidPix, a sort of game software for children that let you do art by yourself through this highly stylized interface to just get kids producing things. And I feel like that kind of fun, gamified software-ish quality is something that defines a lot of EY's games.
Mario Paint would be the closest example to me. Maybe Little Big Planet or Dreams if you want a more modern example.
Let's get to his first game, because this is the least of these qualities. Because his first game, Otaki, on the Famicom Disk System in the 1980s, is a fairly traditional game. It's a shoot-em-up with all your standard controls. You have your primary button for shooting projectiles, and you have a secondary button for doing bombs that will save you from stuff. But the trick in this game is that instead of having a traditional music soundtrack, your shooting and bombing is a generative music function where as you play the game and as you press buttons, you're creating the music for the game. And each weapon that you're using is a different instrument.
The game gives you like a basic rhythm track, and then each level has a different kind of set of notes or a different octave or a specific tone. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this, because it really does sound very good, no matter what you do in this game. I was expecting it to be like a kind of rudimentary generative music type thing, but this game does a really good job at showing how you can play around with music.
Yeah, the music in this game is absolutely fantastic. I like a lot of NES and Famicom music, and I feel like there's a specific sort of tone that they give. If you think of generative music back then in the 80s, you might think that it's just a little bit of beep boops and everything. It is fascinating to me that it's working so well back then.
And this is what really impresses me just right off the bat with EY's career. Okay, so for context, he didn't start out as a video game developer. EY is an installation artist. He started out making flipbooks. He went into art school. He did a lot of stuff in his early years with early animation techniques like phenakistoscopes or zoetropes, you know, those spinny things that animate frames when you spin them around. So he's been interested in that kind of stuff, but he also kind of dabbles in video games. And what impresses me is that when he first got into this, his first game, which he made for the Famicom Disk System, he immediately recognized like the musical potential of the Famicom system, which, I mean, let's be clear here, there were professional musicians doing stuff on the Famicom, but I feel like video game music wasn't taken very seriously until the age of the internet later on, when people started reposting these songs and there became a whole kind of culture around it. EY noticed that there was something intuitively interesting about the Famicom's sound font and the way it produced songs. Which is why at the end of the game, spoilers, when you beat the game, it just straight up gives you a music sequencer, which is unheard of in the late 80s. No other game was doing this, at least not as far as I could tell.
He was doing this while he was a university student. He was getting his master's degree in digital media, I believe. Did you find any information about how he came onto this project? Because I couldn't find anything. It's fascinating to me that a university student was just working on this Famicom game in this new technology, doing something that it seems like nobody has ever done before.
I think he was working for the company and then he decided to make a pitch for it. And then they just kind of took it. He was already working for the company while he was working as a university student. That's all I know.
Interesting. I wonder if he was just like reading about generative music. I'm not a music person. I honestly don't know anything about music, but I know enough to know that there are certain mathematical formulas that are able to create music that sounds pretty nice. And I wonder if he was just studying that in university and just like saw an opportunity to do that digitally.
That's the thing I wasn't really thinking about. If you look at his early works, a lot of them are very just visual arts based. Flip books, animation. He was very interested in how things move and like the illusion of movement in our eyes. But he only really started to get into music later on. First off with Otaki, but then with other things like music and sex.
Right, and even in more recent interviews, he talks about how movement is his primary way of creating art. He thinks about movement and it seems to be the main thing he's trying to work with, which I don't really see in these games because these games are very heavily music based. So that's a strange disconnect between his installation work and his video game work.
I disagree with that. I think a large part of his career actually is dedicated to visualizing music. And how, like, obviously the most practical way would be just to show the staff and all the notes and things like that. But he wants to find more experimental ways of communicating or visualizing music, some of which work better than others. For example, this is not a game of his. He made this installation called Piano as Image Media, where the user could draw notes on a tablet and it went to a live piano which played the notes, but then the notes went out onto this big projected screen as beams of light. So even in that, there's this kind of like transition from visuals to music to visuals. That's completely ignoring the exhibit that he sort of just calls Music Plays Image X Image Plays Music, which he did with Ryuichi Sakamoto. A bunch of things about visualizing music, I think.
Are you considering that to be one of his games then? Because if we think about the formal elements of EY's works, really there's not a big difference between what differentiates a game, what differentiates a museum exhibition, because they're all digital, they're all interactive. Many of them involve elements of music and visuals, and really the only difference I can think of is distribution networks and permanence, because most museum installations are usually temporary, they're more community-based, and it's only in one area, so it's stuck to a location, whereas video games are reproducible, and you generally play them by yourself, and they're relatively permanent. So I'm not really sure where the line is between game and just museum exhibit, but I think there's a lot of overlap between these as well.
I agree. We should spend the next 10 hours talking about this.
Yeah, no, see, like, it's very important talking about what a game is.
No, I mean, honestly, I don't really care. I would say, yeah, those installations are interactive and they might be considered games. I just think we shouldn't just talk about like his strict video game output, like as listed in his Wikipedia page. Because as he stated in multiple interviews, he says his video games are basically extensions of his art. Even his picture books he would make later on are an extension of his ethos. It's not just like separate mediums that are isolated from each other. Toshio Iwai is one person and all of his art is him.
Well, he also has talked about the importance of this external distribution network, because he was talking about how he wanted a more permanent way to be getting this art to more people, and he saw video games as a way to do that later on in his career. So I'm going to be debating you on this for the next hour.
I mean, another thing is that some of these video games are packaged versions of his art installations from the museums. Some of these games, which are later downscaled to like DS games for Electroplankton, were initially played out as entirely on gigantic tables that were larger than you were. So I would say that's a completely different experience you're getting. Is this making any sense at all?
One of these games is Music Insects, and this is a game that he's made several times in his career, at least three times. You are basically drawing on this square area with a bunch of different colors and a bunch of different thicknesses, and you can have four insects on the field that you can choose. You're basically creating a drawing and seeing what music this produces. As these insects cross these lines, they play a different musical tone, and they all work together to make this own melody based on the image that you drew. And this is a game he's made several times, like I said, and they're all very slightly different. They have different visuals, different music, and it's all made in different places. It was made first as a museum exhibit, and then it was made for Sound Factory, and then as Simtoons. So I think it's interesting how he has been revisiting not just the same ideas, but the same exact game, but in a different context. I wonder, like, what that means to him, what it means to have what we might call the same game, but it's in different places, and they seem to have their own purpose to them. So, like, maybe they're for different communities, maybe for their different places and contexts, and I feel like that there's this idea that this music is of its time, and it can be presented in a different way, it'll be part of this new time. The music changes and is time specific. It's ethereal. The music is ethereal only for you, because In a lot of these games, you can't save the music. Aside from Otaki, you're not able to really keep these around forever. They're mostly made for the time that you're playing it. Instead of music software, where the music is produced to be played later, the production is part of the play.
Yeah. To be clear, you could save in some of these games, like Sound Fantasy. So Sound Factory and Sound Fantasy are the same thing. They just had different names for them. You can save in Sound Fantasy. You can save in Simtoons. You could also save in Tenorion, but yeah, in general, there's this overarching thing about how temporary these things are. You're basically meant to play with them, and then you're meant to let them go. And there's so many different ways to look at that, just that feature alone. I feel like part of it is EY is saying music is just kind of something that happens naturally. Again, music insects is a very deliberate choice of them being insects, visions of nature. Later on, he would also make Electroplankton, which is also very nature-focused. The idea being that music is just something that kind of happens naturally, even if you're not planning on it. It also encourages people to let go of things just as spontaneously as they let them in. If there was like an overarching mission statement of EY's works, it would be to change people's impressions of what vision or music can do. His unconventional ways of visualizing music and how they interact with each other is kind of a weird way of saying, look how you can generate music even without using an instrument. Another thing is also getting rid of professionalism, I think. He hasn't really made a game where you just kind of put notes on the staff. He's like, if we get rid of that initial structure, if we make something so free-form that you have no choice but to play with the game, like a kid drawing for the first time, not really caring about whether what he's making is good or not, there could be a lot more potential for discovery. It reminds me of Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies. Brian Eno is a musician. He's made a lot of wonderful stuff for all sorts of different artists, including David Bowie and Talking Heads and things like that. But he's also made this deck of cards called Oblique Strategies, which he recommends to people who are creatively stuck. It's basically just a deck of cards that you draw, and they're very vague and personal, distant statements given to you that you put on your own work. In a similar way, EY is giving you this kind of very detached, but still kind of playful tool that doesn't really care about your input. It's very hard to make a deliberate song with a deliberate time signature in Sound Insects, also in Electroplankton. You have to try very hard to make a specific song that's gonna go, okay, these notes go in this order at this specific time. By doing this, why kind of gives you the permission to let go of being so intentional and perfectionist, and you can just kind of play around with things. And by playing around with things, you might discover new things you like about music that you wouldn't have thought of before.
I think that these games are very childlike in that they are destroying our preconceived notions about how these music areas are structured, and they're giving us some new images, new forms for us to sort of play around with. He started working on these projects because he was working at the Exploratorium, and these different game developers at Maxis and at Nintendo went to his exhibits and they saw how kids were playing with them, and they're like, wow, we can make a game out of this. And then they did.
That's another interesting thing about EY's work to me, is how I think the platforms kind of constrain his work. I don't think he's one of those artists that demands like a very strict artistic vision or that things have to be this way. He's been interviewed over time about like whether he's worried that a lot of his works would be lost to time. And he says something to the effects of, it's more my philosophy I'm trying to promote, and as long as that philosophy is alive, it's okay. I think it's really interesting how he kind of adapts his works to video games to try and make them kind of more accessible and receptive to people. For example, Otaki, made for the Famicom. He could have made any kind of game when it came to generating music. Something like Electroplankton could have worked on the Famicom, but instead he made a side-scrolling shoot-em-up, like a bunch of other games on the Famicom, as a kind of Trojan horse for what he really wants to introduce to the player, which is how cool generative music is and how you can play around with music. Same thing goes with Sound Fantasy. Sound Fantasy was made as a response specifically to Mario Paint, which was released, I think, 1992, and Nintendo was putting more stock in it after Mario Paint did well. So they contacted EY and they had him do Sound Fantasy, which was more of a sound-oriented thing as compared to Mario Paint, which is more drawing-focused. Then when it comes to Simtoons, this was a Maxis joint. Maxis had done this kind of thing for their Sim series before. There are games like SimCity and SimEarth and SimAnt, which were original, made in Maxis. But there were also games like SimTower, which were originally made independently by independent developers. But then Maxis bought that property and helped port it over to America under the name SimTower. This was the case for Simtoons, which was adapted from Sound Fantasy, which by the way, I feel like we should have mentioned by now, was canceled. It's not an actual game you can play. It was canceled by Nintendo, even though they made a full cartridge and cover art and a manual for it. So they were pretty much ready to release it, but Nintendo never really gave a reason for why they didn't release it. I was lucky enough for Maxis though, because they brought the idea over to the Sim series, which was made for the PC. And the thing about the Sim series, I think, is that they simultaneously don't really have an objective, but they also give you a lot of options to play around with, which is why SimTunes is actually one of like the most practical UI applications. They give you so many options with so many different bugs. There's save states, there's a whole network which you can share your songs online with, a bunch of different tools, a way bigger canvas, but in a way it also kind of lacks the playfulness of even something like Sound Fantasy or the original installation. It's very, I can't think of any other way to describe it other than American.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that Maxis was filtering his work into this specific way, whereas Nintendo was doing something very different. When he went to Electroplankton after working on SimTunes, they went a completely different approach where you weren't like saving these or sharing these games. Even though the DS had these capabilities that they wanted to promote, they instead focused on the fact that this was something that anyone could use. Anyone could play Electroplankton. You didn't have to be a gamer. They did this thing where they were showing this software to a bunch of people who had never played a game before, and they'd be trying out something like Electroplankton or Nintendogs, and these quote-unquote non-games were ways for non-gamers to start playing games instead. In this space is a very focusing on the childlike aspects of EY's work through the lens of Nintendo.
Let's talk about what Electroplankton is first, I think.
Nah, they don't need to know that. No. Electroplankton is a series of 10 mini-games, many of which were adapted from his museum installations, where you can use the DS and the stylus and the microphone to make your own music in these predetermined ways. Theme is that there are these electroplankton that make music, little microscopic underwater sea creatures, and you move them around with the stylus, switch up the configurations, and it's a very visual way of showing that these are little creatures that make their own music, and you're sort of directing them, conducting them, as they make the music for you. These are very abstract situations. There isn't any dialogue. There isn't really much of a premise, but it is just focusing on the creation of music through the little faces of these creatures.
There's one mode where you fire electroplankton from a leaf onto other leaves, and they bounce off the leaves, and every time they bounce off a specific leaf, they make a specific note. There's another one where you kind of record your voice into the DS, and then you can pick different shaped electroplankton that kind of morph the shape of your voice. It's very strange.
When Nintendo was promoting this game, they actually made their own Toshio Iwai Museum, which is interesting and fascinating to me because they were selling this game off of his name. They put his name right on the box art. It's really just a picture of one electroplankton and a bunch of blue. It says, created by Toshio Iwai. So, for whatever reason, they really wanted people to know that, like this was an Iwai game. And they wanted to have that sort of personal connection. I assume because this was just a kind of a weird game. If they didn't do that, it's like, this is a person's specific vision, then people would just be especially confused about what kind of game this was. But having that context sort of gave people an opportunity to understand what they were getting into, and using the concept of an auteur to reframe the entire game.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the blank checkiest blank check of a game, if there ever was one, you know? That's not really true.
Well, I'm sure there
definitely
far.
I would say not in terms of like cost, but in terms of like letting somebody do what they want to do, in terms of like how little interest I think EY has in being like a traditional game or like appealing to traditional markets, I would say this is a blank check.
I think the development of this game had a single digit number of developers. This was a very small project in creating it, but in the marketing, I would absolutely say that. Imagine if someone's like little itch.io project suddenly got literally Nintendo to market this for millions of dollars, create your own museum, and make this as one of their flagship titles for their new consoles. That would be mind-blowing. No one would ever do that, but for some reason, this happened with Toshio Iwai.
Well, I think a big part of this is that Iwai really believes in this project. I would say Electroplankton, out of all the games that we've talked about, I think it's his most uncompromised vision. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say this is the most uncompromised one. It seems like the one where he had the most creative control, and it seemed like the people at Nintendo strongly believed in what he's doing. Like, there are interviews with Iwata and Miyamoto talking about how important it was for them to get Iwai why out there after they saw his work at the Exploratorium. And later on, it's still, like, implanted in Nintendo's memory through the Super Smash Bros. Series. And also, well, online, didn't seem to know what to do with it. Viewers were like, this isn't really a game, but... like, I guess it's fun, 7 out of 10. And then there are a bunch of people on internet forums that were like, what is this? I'm not paying $40 for this. Maybe I'll get it for $5 somewhere, but this is basically a tech demo. I don't care. There's just still very little discussion about Electroplankton, even though Nintendo put so much work into trying to get people to care about this game. And, like, in the museum that they created for Toshio Iwai Live, I think it was called, where they were presenting Iwai stuff, they had many of his museum installations, and they even had sound facts in that museum that they created for him. But you weren't allowed to play Sound Factory. It was just the box inside a plastic exhibit. But they put so much work into marketing this guy, but it seems like nobody really cared that much, which is absolutely fascinating for a big company to do.
I think part of it was that Nintendo was taking a lot of big swings. Like, you saw what they were doing with, like, Wii Music and Wii Play around the same time. I think they were trying to push their consoles as something for everybody, but also as, like, an application. They had, like, Mario Clock and all that crap. This is just, like, really petty conspiratorial stuff, but another thing could just be because they felt so bad about not releasing Sound Factory that they decided to give Iwai money to do his own project. That could be another reason why they let him into this kind of stuff. But I'm sure the bigger third reason would be that they genuinely believed in Iwai's work. They wouldn't put a Super Smash Bros. Stage of his work years later if they didn't think it was valuable in some way.
I can see that. Yeah, they did make a lot of big swings. If I was in 2004 or whatever, and I saw Electroplankton, Nintendogs, and Big Brain Academy, a music game, a game where you take care of a dog, and a game that is basically a bunch of quizzes about math, and, like, you're telling me, okay, two of these are going to be incredibly popular. I don't think I would be able to tell which ones. Maybe Electroplankton could have done that in a different universe. So, yeah, I can see Nintendo genuinely believing in this project.
This is why the DS was so great. You just had stuff like Ghost Trick and Ace Attorney, but you also had stuff like My Stop Smoking Coach and, like, Learn Spanish with Everybody. Those are real games,
okay,
by the way.
But on the Wonder Swan, you could have gotten a pregnancy test, so that's a better portable game console right there.
This kind of irritates me also, because we're still talking about the reception to this day. I mean, the reception's really interesting, but I feel like getting past all that, I think Electroplankton is a really good game. It's really good. Everyone should download it and play it if they have it. Yes. It cuts to the core of this thing of what I want, which is, like, coming up with new ways of music that you couldn't even imagine before. This is just, like, a personal thing, but I've been struggling recently with, like, trying to imagine things outside of what the constraints of the medium are. You know, there's a lot of people talking about how, like, cinema is dead, or, like, gaming is dead, or music is dead, because people can't imagine better versions of it.
Every year they do that, where they say this medium
exactly.
is dying.
Every year they do that, right? We've been in that kind of, like, tar pit ever since the 21st century started, basically. And I feel like what Electroplankton does, along with a few other games and a few other works, is it points in a new direction, being like, hey, there are things you can imagine if you just play around with it, or if you just deconstruct your expectations of it. For example, my favorite game on Electroplankton, which I think everybody should try, it's called Beatness. It's the ninth game in the collection. They basically give you, like, five vertical column of plankton, and then they play the bass line to an NES song. Again, harkening back to that Famicom sound chip. I mean, back then with Otaki, he was doing it to be cutting edge, but now it's kind of for nostalgia's sake. But they play the baseline of an NES game, and they give you the sound font to that NES song on five vertical columns. Of course, it's not like a traditional musical staff or anything, so you just kind of mash around on the screen. And I'm not even kidding, I feel like whatever you put in, it sounds good. It sounds, like, really good. So you're basically making alternate versions of the NES song with the same sound font, but it's completely different. And that's so cool. It's taking, like, the old methods of history and playing around with them, just kind of scrambling around the pieces to create new versions of that history. What would the world have been like if the song that was made for the NES sounded like this, or sounded like that? And once you take that idea and you expand it to anything, what would the this movie have looked like if he brought it in this direction? Or what would this game have looked like if it became popular instead of this other game? There's all these kinds of alternate histories that we haven't even imagined because we're not living in those worlds. But once you open up the space to kind of imagine, I think the world opens up and gaming is no longer dead or whatever. That's what it means to me personally, though. That's why I really love it.
Yeah, this period of gaming, the mid-2000s, there was still a fascination with this technology and seeing what you can do with something new, like touch controls or motion controls or a mouse, seeing how we can sort of expand the gaming medium with these things. Whereas in more recent years, let's look at Astro's Playroom, which is a PS5 game showing off the features of the PlayStation 5 controller, where instead of really trying to create its own new genre, it is a relative formulaic 3D platformer. It's a very good 3D platformer, but it uses the, say, analog trigger and friction there. I don't know what it's actually called. It uses that to sort of say, hey, we can enhance the platforming experience by adding these touch controls. But it doesn't try to find new ways of creating different kinds of software. Instead, uses the hardware to support already existing software. And I kind of feel sad that that doesn't seem to exist to the same extent anymore. I mean, we are seeing that with, say, generative AI, but that's not going very well. I'm not going to touch that. But I think it's sad that we don't have that same fascination with the new digital technologies anymore.
I mean, I think I'm going to have to ask Grok if it's dying. I don't think it is. He'll tell me. I feel like people make a lot of fun about what people were doing in the 2000s. Like, oh, we really thought motion controls were the future. And like Kinect and the Wii and how those basically completely face planted. But it is, I'm not going to say it's preferable, but it is definitely more interesting than like, I don't know, the period where Dark Souls came out and every game was Dark Souls and then they just kept making Dark Souls. Games are definitely fun. I'm not saying they're bad now. That should not be what you take away from what I'm saying. I'm saying that people are taking fewer risks now, and maybe that's okay because the industry is collapsing. It's kind of a chicken or egg scenario where lack of innovation breeds collapsing industry breeds lack of innovation. There are people trying things. I mean, there was that Playdate console that a bunch of indie developers came up with. There's a bunch of indie games doing pretty fun stuff that are just like original, but I feel like AAA companies have kind of stepped down, and that is a shame. I do want to see what people like EY could do with more modern technology.
Yeah, he still hasn't really come back into the gaming industry like 20 years on, which I think can be applied to that technological factor. There isn't really a fascination with what new technology can do. I think that after the iPhone came out and the App Store came with a bunch of people trying stuff out and then getting burned out, people just don't want to do new technology. People already have a piece of technology that does everything they want in the way they want to, and it is efficient and it's pretty good, and people don't need a piece of software that will just be like, oh hey, look at this cool stuff you can do with this new technology. And instead they're like, yep, I know this technology, I can make it work pretty well, aside from, again, generative AI, not touching that.
This kind of brings me to what I think is his opus. It's not Electroplankton,
really.
Yeah, I think it's actually the Tenorion, EY's Tenorion. I didn't consider it a video game.
Really? I haven't played this game, so you need to tell me about this.
I haven't either.
Oh, okay.
So basically, Tenorion was initially made for the Wonderswan. It was this very experimental musical sequencer that they just kind of commissioned him to make. What I'm actually talking about is what came out later, 6 years after 2001 in 2007, the Yamaha Tenorion, which is a physical version of this sequencer. It's a full instrument. It's like a very heavy kind of square-based instrument with, it's a 16 by 16 grid, I think, of buttons, and they basically all do different things. It's very hard to describe visually. It works as an original sequencer. There's also a mode where you can tap out like a triangle on the sequencer, and there's a dot that goes in between the lines, and every time it hits a corner, it makes a sound. There's also another mode where you can make a bouncing ball. Whenever it hits the walls of the sequencer, it makes a sound. So it's like Electroplankton, but within a physical instrument. But you can also use it as like a decent sequencer, and it's so decent that it's become a kind of cult item. It's been used by a bunch of artists like Bjork, Fortet, Hans Zimmer. Ariana Grande said in a Hot Ones interview that she owned one when she was 14 and that was a big deal for her, which is insane. It feels insane to me that this kind of experimental installation artist went from like flipbooks and being like, isn't animation cool? We should all just play around with it, to making like a full-fledged instrument that people can use but still play around with. It's like the most successful version of his ethos, I think, in terms of like promoting music as something to play around with. And I think that's beautiful.
That is fascinating. I didn't even see any any of that during my research, so I'm glad that you found that. Is this still something that, like, you can buy, or is it a limited edition kind of thing?
It's out of production now, but you can get it for, like, $700 to $1,500. People now look at it as something that, like, obviously you don't need it to make good music, but it's cool to have, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
This is the cool thing about talking about someone who isn't really known specifically for making games, is that they have this whole other kind of life outside of games to talk about.
We haven't even talked about his picture books, which is now arguably what he is most well known for. Not all this installation or video game stuff. He's most well known for his picture books now. He's a picture book author.
I didn't know that either. Jeez, he is a big, big Wikipedia page, and then there's a lot of interviews that talk about just different aspects of his work. And it seems like there's always something new to find. I mean, he is a multimedia artist, so he's doing multimedia. Are these in English or are these Japanese picture books?
Some of them have been translated to English. So for context, he talks about this in an interview. Let me bring up the specific interview because I'm going to recommend it at the end. It's a very good interview. But he talks about the birth of his daughter specifically changing him and changing his design philosophy and how he wanted to make things. So he made this picture book for her called The House of 100 Stories. It's basically this vertical picture book which has 100 pages, and you start at the bottom of the tower and you flip a page, and every new page is a different floor, and there's a bunch of different things of each floor. It's basically just about exploring all the wonders of life as you climb up this gigantic tower. I didn't actually read it, so I don't know what happens when you get to the top, but it got so popular that he made a bunch of different kinds of variations to it. So there's also like the ocean with 100 floors where you go down into the ocean. There's the sky of 100 floors where you climb up into the sky. He made a bunch of these, and he talks about this in the same interview about how these picture books have outperformed all of his video games and all of his installations in terms of popularity. And he says, and I quote, "Whenever I think about this, I have no idea how to view my achievements." He's completely confused about his career.
That is so fascinating. That is what he's most known for, making kind of stuff for his daughter. I guess It does help that at the 100th level, you find out that Grover was the monster the whole time.
But what the hell? You just spoiled it. I was going to read all of them.
I'm sorry.
Oh, man, this is why this podcast sucks. Personally, I think in response to him saying, "I have no idea how to view my achievements," I think his career was a success. He talks about in the same interview. He said, "When I was producing these games, Otaki, Sound Fantasy, Electroplankton, I thought they would change the world, but they all got discontinued and didn't become big hits. Meanwhile, this picture book, which I didn't even plan on being a big thing, just kind of completely changed Japan, and I don't know how to think about this." Doing research for this episode, I kept finding comments on YouTube about Simtoons or Electroplankton, saying, "Simtoons inspired me to become a musician," or "Electroplankton is part of the reason I'm an experimental musician now." And maybe EY's works didn't have the far-reaching implications that he wanted to, but the people he reached, whoever bought and spent $40 for Electroplankton, some of them felt bummed out. Some of them gave the 1-star reviews, but a bunch of other people, especially kids, I think, really interacted with it and were inspired by it. So I think his work was definitely not a waste. Not that that was ever up for debate, but I think he reached a lot more people than even he would have expected.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely had an impact. I think it's pretty sad how games don't really have the same permanence that other mediums tend to do, and I'd like to see more people playing these games in the future. In the end, I feel like his legacy will be in his other works, where people seem to care more about older art, which is sad in a way, but it's good that he had this whole impact. Do you want to talk about our recommendations?
Yes, so you start.
All right, well, mine is a lot shorter. I feel like I had a little bit of difficulty finding good articles and good paratext about this guy. Wired article from 1997, portrait of the artist as a young geek. So this is made before Simtoons and before Electroplankton, but I think it's a really fascinating look at the historical way that these were viewed during that time period, where people are like sort of fascinated by this idea of digital art and like people making video games as a quote unquote real artist. It's just a really interesting perspective in that moment of his career and where he was, and also how the sort of Anglosphere was viewing his work as well. And if I had to recommend a game, it would be Electroplankton. I think Electroplankton is such a special and interesting game that I can't imagine recommending anything else. Although Otoki is pretty close. Otoki is fascinating as a historical object as well. But yeah, those are my main two. How about you?
My main recommendation would probably be the Yamaguchi Center for Arts and Media, or YCAM, the interview with him. It's a full 30-minute retrospective where he talks you through all those works. It includes that quote I talked about earlier, and it's fully translated. It's pretty wonderful. Half an hour long, very breezy watch. Even if you're not familiar with EY's works, I think he does a pretty good job at taking you through it. And I've also made two playlists, although I may not release the second one, of songs that I found online on YouTube for Simtoons and the Tenorion, of songs that I really enjoy. And as for games, I would definitely recommend Electroplankton. I would recommend that you look at videos of the Tenorion if my playlist doesn't come out, or if you want to see more. And I would also recommend Otaki. I also want to mention, although not necessarily recommend, Bikuri Mouse, which is the one game we didn't talk about in his career. This is a collaboration of Uruma Delvey, which was, I don't know why I said was, they're still operating, I think. They're this husband-wife artist duo that was kind of doing the same thing as EY and trying to promote things for kids and getting kids to play around with it. It's interesting to me because it's the only entry in his gamography that doesn't involve music nearly at all. It's mainly about mouse controls for the PlayStation 2 mouse, which was a thing I didn't even know existed. It basically involves you drawing a bunch of things with mice. There's a drawing mode. There's a mode where you like bounce eggs into a pan by drawing trampolines. My favorite mode in the game is there's this diving board game where you draw whoever's at the top of a diving board and then you just kind of fling them into the ocean and you can't save it. So it's a very kind of zen way of making you draw things and getting rid of them that I think lends to EY's other work. I don't know how much creative input he had in it. It is credited as an Uruma Delvey project mainly, but they collaborated with EY. And you can see some things. Things like there's a whole computer drawing mode where you draw crystals and they make generative music. Oh, also check out, I don't know how to pronounce it, but he did computer graphics for this kid show in Japan.
I was
trying
to find this. I was looking everywhere online to figure this out.
Well, I'm going to include a playlist to video clips because I found like full episodes of them. They're absolutely insane. The entire show takes place on a green screen with two kids and they're like running around the room. He was inspired by Pee-wee's Playhouse. So it's just like a bunch of kids running in place. And then there are alternate modes where there are like women presenting the news and they pull up things on the computer. The entire screen is a computer with a GUI. And they're like tapping the side of the screen to like bring up tabs that they can't see with computer modes in front of you. And there's a whole character who's like a talking poop in the toilet. There was a whole kind of like early Twitch Plays Pokemon mode where they had kids submit sumo wrestlers from home onto the screen and made them shout into a telephone live on air to make the sumo wrestlers fight each other. Absolutely insane. We haven't even gotten into like any of that. Please go check it out. And somebody please translate it because I had no idea what's going on half the time.
Beat Takeshi and his consequences have been a blessing on the human race. So now I want to hear about who you're suggesting for the next auteur that we're covering, because I picked this last one and it's your turn. So hit me with it.
Yep, ball's in my court. And we're probably going to release this episode like way later, but I'm about to go on a trip, so I am going to recommend something that I've played a lot of but you have not played that much of. They are my favorite game dev, period. I wanted you to play it later on, but now that I'm going on this trip, I figured it would be a pretty good time. I am, of course, talking about the indescribable Stephen Gilmurphy, also known as The Catamites, also known as Harmony Zone, also known as Garment District, also known as A1 Reviews. He has so many different names, but he's mainly known as The Catamites. He's most well known for his RPG Maker game, Space Funeral, which was, and it still is, a big cult RPG Maker game up there with games like Ib and Mad Father. Where he differentiates from a lot of those RPG Maker creators is that he's still doing things. His most recent game just came out. It's called Anthology of the Killer. It came out in 2024. I don't really know how to describe his work. He once described his work in an interview. He said he was trying to make dense but breezy games, and I feel like that's as good of a descriptor as I'll be able to get, but that kind of misses out on the kind of eclectic art styles that he mashes together, his surreal humor, his Irish millennial aesthetic, his references to intellectual work that he integrates into his Final Fantasy pastiche RPGs that aren't even really RPGs. There is so much here to talk about. If there is only one game I have to recommend to you, it's Anthology of the Killer. That's a collection of 9 free games he released over the course of 4 years from 2020 to 2024. Other games, probably Goblet Grotto. That's a kind of take on the RPG that is very hard to explain. Magic Wand, which is a take on Final Fantasy specifically. What else? Sorry, I'm getting too excited about this.
Yeah, I can see how excited you are. So yeah. My background with these games is that I've played Space Funeral on my own, and then I have played, based off of Galvin's recommendation, Number Beautiful Postcards. I want to say 8 Beautiful Postcards.
10.
10 Beautiful Postcards. Beautiful round number. Yeah. I played a lot of that, and I was really interested in these games because they're relatively non-representational, a little bit abstract, and I am interested in seeing where these goes because I really haven't played anything like 10 Beautiful Postcards. There are a few games like Space Funeral, but 10 Beautiful Postcards was a really unique experience. I want to see what else is going on over here. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to looking at these games and trying them out, and I'll try to get into as many as I can while you're on vacation.
All right, thank you. And as always, I'm Galvin.
And I'm Author Function.
Thank you for listening.
How do we end these episodes? Yeah, that's it.
That's it. I don't know. We'll come up with a better sign off later.